case this afternoon is case number 78476, State of Nevada versus Paul Lewis Browning. We have Mr. DiGiacomo representing the appellant, Mr. Ford representing the respondent. I see Ms. Menengo's here as well on behalf of the respondent. So, Mr. DiGiacomo, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, may I reserve 5 minutes for
rebuttal? Yes, you may.
May it please the court. My name is Mark DiGiacomo. I represent the state of Nevada in this action. With me is Michael Scarborough. He's also a deputy district attorney in my office.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Scarborough.
34 years ago, almost to the day, Hugo Elson was killed inside his jewelry store. The perpetrator stole a bunch of jewelry from inside that store, and when he did so, he reached inside a case and broke the glass out of the back side of that case. On the inside, where no customer's fingerprint would ever be, is the fingerprint of Paul Lewis Browning. 20 to 30 minutes after the crime, Paul Lewis Browning is captured. He's in possession of the majority of the jewelry from this crime scene. Underneath the stairs in the apartment he is in is the murder weapon, now conclusively identified with Hugo Elson's blood under the handle. And despite these facts, those facts alone, I would convict Paul Lewis Browning of the murder which he has been convicted. The district court precluded the state from proceeding, and the question was why. And there was a certain part of it is the Ninth Circuit. This case went through tortured appellate history. I've been a lawyer for 20 years. My first appearance was as a law clerk at the evidentiary hearing on the PCR in this particular case. This case has gone through a number of hurdles. But if you read the opinions in this case, your direct appeal, the opinion from the Nevada Supreme Court, the PCR opinion from the Nevada Supreme Court, if you read the district court original order in this case out of the first out of the district court, Judge Pawlikowski, but also the district court opinion from the judge in federal court. Then you get to the Ninth Circuit. And one of the things that district court Judge Herndon never addressed, and one of the things that I complained severely about, is he stopped his analysis on the day of the jury trial, the jury verdict in 1987. And what he fails to recognize is the defense spent 30 years investigating the underlying facts of this case, and they were able to establish essentially three things that the Ninth Circuit found, all of which are cured as of this date. One was, and I have to note that the dissent in this case, because it was a three-judge panel, and one of the dissenting judges dissents, and his dissent is pretty vehement. He starts his dissent by saying, today's majority gives short shrift to the Supreme Court's admonitions. Along the way, it misapplies Supreme Court case law, embarks on its own fact-finding mission, and overrules the jury's credibility determinations. A meaningful application of our deferential standard review under AEDPA, by contrast, compels the conclusion that the Nevada Supreme Court was not objectively unreasonable in rejecting Browning's ineffective assistance claim. Well, what did they find?
What do we do with the majority? Obviously, I guess we like that part of it, but we got to live with the majority, though.
And here's what the majority said. Mm-hmm. Of all this 30 years of investigation, here was the prejudice to Mr. Browning. There was the majority, and the dissent have a different take on this, but it is an alleged Brady violation by the prosecutor. The witness testified, I was never promised anything, and nobody ever told me he was going to do anything for me. The prosecutor testified, I never did told him I was going to do something. But then later on, the prosecutor did something. This is the 1980s, probably wouldn't happen that way in this modern age. The Nevada Supreme Court, on the original PCR opinion, said something to the effect of, look, the prosecutor should have told somebody that he was going to do this for the witness, and thus it should have been turned over. We're going to find it's a Brady violation, but we're going to find it's harmless, essentially is what the court said. Now, the Ninth Circuit says, if he didn't tell the witness, then it's not a Brady violation. So we're going to interpret what the Nevada Supreme Court said as saying that the prosecutor and the witness were lying, and therefore there's a Brady violation. But either way, that's cured, because they now are aware that the prosecutor gave Mr. Wolf some sort of benefit. If Mr. Wolf ever testifies in this case, when I say testify, I mean prior testimony, the court could just reject and not allow the testimony of Randy Wolf, and then There's a non-issue there. So what was the second issue they found? They find that, well, first of all, they say that the Nevada Supreme Court found it was a Brady violation, or, yeah, well, Brady violation, but also ineffective assistance of counsel, for the prosecutor not to be aware that an officer 13 years later, 11 years after he stopped being an officer, was going to come in and testify to something that wasn't in a police report. And that is related to the shoe prints in this case, and the fact that, and I don't really understand this distinction, the difference between him using the term Jerry Curl or the victim in this case using the Jerry Curl. I don't even know how that's necessarily dispositive. If witnesses described the hair wrong or right, the two other witnesses that see...
Did the state not argue to the jury that it probably came from some white witness who didn't know the difference?
Sure, that's what Mr. Seaton argued at the time.
So,
but I don't know how that's highly relevant to the analysis of why is it that we can't present that evidence now. Officer, or former Officer Brandon is available. He's alive. He's well. He can come and he can testify, and he can testify to his conclusions. Hence, why there's no prejudice from the finding of the Ninth Circuit. Moreover, the Ninth Circuit opinion talks about the footprints. The footprints is sort of like the giant red herring in this case. Officer Brannon testifies at the evidentiary hearing in 1999, and I have the cites for it because it's 5AA. He first talks about the locked door. Then he talks about the footwear impressions that he sees at 11:43 in the record. And what his testimony is, first of all, and it's important, this is an important fact, is that the door is locked when he first arrives on scene. And I'll get to that in just a minute. But he says when he goes inside, he sees the victims in the back of the store. He goes up to the victim and there's a large pool of blood sort of surrounding where he's been stabbed in his chest side area. And he says there appears to be footwear impressions in that blood. That is not the two large footwear impressions that are near the front door that is photographed and talked about by CSA Horn at 1AA 45 and 46. Officer Brandon was never shown in that evidentiary hearing, and you can read the entire testimony, the two footwear impressions that they're claiming couldn't have been possibly left by Paul Lewis Browning. Not that any of that matters, because no perpetrator went out the front door of this particular crime scene. The door was a buzz-in, buzz-out door only. Meaning, how did the perpetrator get out the front door after the door closed behind him when he came into the store? He couldn't. He went out the back door. And how do you know that's absolutely true from the record? Because Deborah Coe, the witness who says Browning is coming by the front of the store when I'm on just the south side looking through the window, says, I see Mr. Browning come down the sidewalk, but there's no way he came out the front door. That's true. Nobody could go out the front door. Josie Elson has to buzz Officer Brandon into the crime scene. And the photographs from the crime scene clearly establish this is not 2019 where you could just push your way out that door. It's a buzz-in, buzz-out door. The door's locked. But all of that is something we can litigate today, none of which the district court would allow us to litigate, all of which is cured. So there is nothing in the Ninth Circuit opinion that would somehow prevent us. So what did we get to? We get to claims of speculation by the defense of what we would have liked to ask. My favorite being, we would have liked to have asked Josie Elson whether or not those footwear impressions were there or not, and now we can't because she's deceased. Well, what they even say it in their brief, but what they failed to mention to anybody is they've interviewed Josie Elson. Randy Pike didn't, but during the PCR proceedings, they spoke to Josie Elson. They won't tell us the answer to the question. All of this has been investigated. The fact that they can't come up with a single piece of evidence that they can't present to this jury should not preclude me from using the transcripts, but I even offered to do that for Judge Herndon. Look, if you don't like the cross-examination of any of these witnesses, exclude all of the prior testimony. I still would have Deborah Coe, I would have Browning in possession of the knife, I'd have DNA underneath the handle of that knife, and I would have the fingerprint on the inside portion of the case where the jewelry was taken from, and I'd have Browning in possession of the jewelry 30 minutes after the crime. What jury is not going to convict Paul Lewis Browning of this crime? And everything they complain about, every single thing that they say, oh, we can't do this, we can't do that, it's all we want to impeach witnesses that are no longer available. Well, if I don't call the witnesses, what's the harm to you? There is no harm to you if you can't impeach the witnesses that are inculpatory. To the extent that they have exculpatory, like Martha Hager, she was presented at the last trial. Her prior transcript is available. William Hoffman, his prior transcript is available. So what are they missing? What don't they have that they can't present? And the answer is nothing. And that, to me, is the analysis of this case. You could potentially make a prejudice.
I haven't heard from the defense, Mr. Giacomo, but I was wondering if you could address what I understood to be a defense theory about the association of the Wolves, or Wolf and Vanessa with a Cuban individual. Isn't that something that they want to develop? Maybe I misunderstood the arguments.
There is, but there isn't exactly any evidence that that's true. I mean, it's pure speculation. Now, they have Frederick Ross. His testimony is preserved. He's the guy who came forward, met Browning in prison. Then he was dying of HIV or something, and so they preserved his testimony in the PCR hearing, who sort of gives Mr. Browning his defense, but he has that available to him. So what would prevent him from presenting that analysis in the particular case?
That this other individual supposedly committed the crime.
Correct. Yeah. He had Frederick Ross to do it, and I see only have 4 minutes left, so I will reserve.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time, Mr. Giacomo?
Oh, is this my full 15? Yeah, I want to reserve the last.
Okay, you got 3:45 left. Okay. Mr. Ford?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chief Justice. Please, the court. My name is Tim Ford. I represent Mr. Browning, along with Yvette Meningo, who's here at trial with us. A lot of the things Mr. DiGiacomo just said are not true, or are certainly incomplete. Judge Herndon listened to these arguments through 4 different oral arguments, 21 briefs. He gave the state 2 extensions of time to file additional briefs if they had additional information to come up and try and show these things. And it turns out that what they say just isn't true. Let me just start with this whole thing about the locked front door. Mr. DiGiacomo just said he said this to Judge Herndon, I'm going to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the killer could not have run out the front door. Well, Mrs. Elson, the only eyewitness to the case, said on the night of the in question that the perpetrator ran out the front door. And she said it to Detective Levos, the first detective on the scene, the only detective that ever interviewed her.
Did she say she saw that?
Yes. Well, she says, Detective Levos writes down that, yeah, she said that she said the perpetrator ran out the front door, and then she went and next door to get Mrs. Cow. Detective Levos is dead. Mrs. Elson is dead. Did Mr. DiGiacomo's right? If that's true, and he ran out the front door, then Mrs. Cow is actually a witness for us. She's an exculpatory witness because there's no way that Paul Browning is in front of that store several minutes later if he's run out the front door before Mrs. Elson even went for help. So that's just one thing of the many. We've listed them in our brief. I hope you've had a chance to read them. Many, many things like that.
Mr. Ford, here's the problem I'm having evaluating whether it was error to bar retrial is that Judge Herndon did not go through and kind of do the hard work and say, this evidence is going to be out, this is coming in. So how can I evaluate whether or not you can go forward or whether or not that was error? Like, maybe it's premature until it moves to a point where we can actually see what's there and those evidentiary rulings have been made.
Well, Judge Herndon did say that he would exclude the transcripts because he found, and it's in his findings, that he agreed with the Ninth Circuit's statement that Mr. Pike had been wholesale ineffective, never interviewing any of the key witnesses, asking none of the key witnesses anything about what happened that night. He agreed with that, and he decided he was going to exclude all the transcripts. He said it. That's when Mr. DiGiacomo said, well, I'll go ahead and convict him anyway. at that point, we got to look and, you know, the judge went down the findings of the different things that he'd been informed about.
But aren't you over-reading the Ninth Circuit opinion a bit? They have the phrase wholesale ineffective. But in evaluating, and in evaluating the COA, they say Judge Jones was too narrow in and precise in what he was going to allow. So they allow a broader one. But when they get to the bottom line, they're still on the three pieces of evidence, if you will, the footprints, the hair, and the other. But so they didn't reverse and say this man cannot be retried.
No, and as Judge Hernan found in one of the findings, they had no idea that Mrs. Elson was dead. They had no idea that Mr. Aoki was dead, who the person who tested that knife and found no blood on it from the Las Vegas Municipal Crime Lab. Back in 1985, the person who handled that knife along with Mr. Elson's blood in 1985, when we had very different laboratory procedures because of DNA evaluation, we can never ask Mr. Aoki about that testing. They're going to claim he just told you, oh, this is the murder weapon. This knife has Mr. Elson's blood on it. One thing, that's not what their DNA shows. It's very questionable what it shows. But number two, Mr. Aoki, their own person.
Can't you all litigate that? I'd like to ask you this. If the judge said, I'm going to exclude all the transcripts, and the state says, fine, we'll try him without the transcripts, could you give me, like, two or three examples of how the defendant is prejudiced in offering your defense to a case tried like that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Start with a knife. He said, that's the keystone. Well, how did the knife get there? The knife came not from Paul Browning. It came from Vanessa Wolf next to her apartment. She's dead. Nobody's ever asked her questions from the defense side about how she put it there, why she hid it there. She had no reason to hide it there if she wasn't guilty or wasn't involved in this or her husband wasn't.
But so what does that have to do with DNA?
Well, the DNA that was the
all it's going to show is maybe her unknown DNA touch on it.
Her DNA is not on there. Paul Browning's DNA is not on there, even according to them. According to them, there is a trace. There are a certain number of locations, not enough to really make a match, but something for Mr. Elson. Mr. Aoki tested that back in 1985. Their crime lab tested in 1985. He found no blood, nothing. We can't call him. We can't question him. They say, well, we'll just put up his police report or his lab report, and it says NR, but then we'll argue about what NR means. NR, as Judge Hearn said, means no result. If you're testing for blood and there's no result, that means there's no blood. So they're going to say Mr. Aoki was wrong. We can't call Mr. Aoki and have a jury decide if Mr. Aoki is truthful or not. We can't ask Ms. Wolf and have a jury decide, well, that knife, where did it come from? With no testimony from Vanessa Wolf?
Well, Ms. Wolf said it came from Mr. Browning. So well, if that's not there, then you have a knife in the area.
Coming
right?
From the person who's jewelry, Mr. DiGiacomo just said Mr. Browning's there with the lion's share of the jewelry, right. Remember? He's actually in the Wolf's hotel room.
Right.
Never explained except by Mr. Browning, who says they lured him there in order to frame him for this thing. With seven pieces of jewelry in different parts of the room, the Wolves have 63 pieces of jewelry that they later turn in to the police. And then Randy Wolf
but
goes
why
off.
Do you need the Wolves for that? If they turn it into the police, then the police can say, hey, they gave me 63 pieces of jewelry. They kept some. They wore it at the preliminary hearing. I mean, how is the absence? The Wolves didn't seem very helpful for you.
Well,
how is the absence of their testimony preclude you from putting these pieces in?
Because we can't confront them with the facts and question them and have the jury assess whether they're telling the truth or not or whether, in fact, they were the person who framed them. We can't ask Randy Wolf about the Cubans. He put a kite into the jail. It's written down, never came out at trial. He needed to be protected from Cubans. We have Ms. Hager saying he was with somebody who could have been a Cuban. We have Mr. Ross saying he was with a Cuban. We have Ms. Gaylord, who's lost thanks to Randy Pike's ineffectiveness, who said that he had a Cuban associate. We can't put on any of that. There's none of that available to us. Deborah Coe, I mentioned before, he says Deborah Coe is his witness. If Mrs. Elson's telling the truth to Detective Levos, Mrs. Coe's our witness. But we can't call Mrs. Elson. We can't call Detective Levos. So Mr. DiGiacomo can argue, as he did below, oh, Detective Levos wrote it down wrong.
The jury can never assess that. The Supreme Court, we cited the Bullcoming case and a couple of the recent cases on confrontation of the Supreme Court. Just putting in a piece of paper or a police report is not what the Sixth Amendment allows. The Sixth Amendment allows you to call and question witnesses.
But Mr. Ford, it may be that Judge Herndon doesn't let that piece of paper in. Like, we don't know what evidence Judge Herndon, in addition to the transcripts, may or may not exclude. So why, it just feels as if we're jumping in a little early, and if they think they can prove it, then they try, and if they can't, you move for a verdict before it even goes to a jury.
But that's the key. The question is not what they can do. The question is what we cannot do. The problem is not whether Judge Herndon will or will not allow Mr. Aoki's report in that says no blood. The problem is that the jury can't look at Mr. Aoki, and we can't ask him questions to show that, in fact, he was careful. And when he said no blood, he meant no blood.
But didn't they take apart the knife subsequent? So the blood, when he said no blood, it was on the outside of the knife that they tested. And then recently, or sometime in the past 30 years now, they've taken it apart and found untested blood inside?
It's what they've said they've done. We don't know what Mr. Aoki did. We won't know, can't know what Mr. Aoki did because we can't question him because he wasn't interviewed. He wasn't asked any questions about this at trial. The only thing he testified to at trial, remember, was the blood on the jacket that Mr. Seaton told the jury justified all by itself a conviction in 5 minutes and then turned out of DNA testing not to be Mr. Elson's blood. So that's another example. The fingerprints in the store. Marsha Gaylord told Mr. Pike before trial, one of the only witnesses he ever interviewed, that she was in that store with Browning the day before. Now, we have a dispute between a criminalist that was called in post-conviction and their people about where that fingerprint actually was. But we can't do anything without a witness who says, wait a minute, there's a reason for that fingerprint to be there. He was in the store. We can never call her. She's gone. That's another witness we can't call. Everything that they're talking about fits into that category. Excuse me. The jewelry and the Casio watch, you know, they say now there's two fingerprints. Well, when they originally looked at the fingerprints, they said there was no fingerprints on anything other than the Casio watch, which is not part of something that was taken in the robbery. How do we know that? Well, because this was a Swiss jewelry maker. This was a craftsman. He didn't have broken electronic $4 watches. But Mr. Browning says it was his watch. So that Casio watch was never even admitted at trial because there was no connection, and nobody ever asked Ms. Elson, was this something in your store? So we can't know, but he's going to argue that's a thumbprint that incriminates Mr. Browning. And we can't call Ms. Elson to say, no, it doesn't. It doesn't have anything to do with it.
What's the contest on the evidence as to the fingerprint being inside the case or on a side of the case that was not available to the general public?
It's complicated and has to do with the shape of the counter. Mr. Sweeto testified in post-conviction. I believe it is in part of the appendix. He was a criminalist, and he explained how he did not believe that the fingerprint was in a place that was not accessible to the public.
So why can't that be presented to a jury?
Well, it could be, but we have no explanation for the fingerprint being there at all, because we have no Ms. Gaylord. So it doesn't do us any good to say, well, this could have come in at some other time, and then we have no witness to testify he was in there at another time.
Mr. Browning could testify, and he could say he was in there a separate time, right? So there is a witness, whether you want to call him or not, there is another witness that can testify to those facts.
Well, but you're entitled under the Sixth Amendment to compel witnesses on your behalf, not just yourself. No defense lawyer would ever want to go to trial with just his client without any supporting evidence for his client. And now that's what we're stuck with.
Have you explored stipulations with the state at all? I mean,
no, Mr. DiGiacomo has been absolute that he's going to contest all that. He's going to hotly contest. He's going to disagree with everything. And this whole question of shouldn't Judge Herndon have waited, he was never asked to wait. Mr. DiGiacomo never said, oh, this things will change, you know, you'll be able to see more later, we can sort this out later. He said, no, we're going to contest all these things, just as he said here today. The defense hasn't lost a thing. All these dead witnesses don't matter at all. This case is fine. We can go forward.
That was the state's position.
Why didn't you put him to his proof? What's the harm in that?
Because, once again, we can't...
Then we could assess legitimately your prejudice.
I'm sorry?
It strikes me, I'm concerned about this being premature, where it's kind of a moving target as far as what the state would present on retrial in their case in chief, and how your claims of prejudice would match up against that. So the reported cases seem to say you go through at least to the extent of the state's case in chief. We're in a novel area, I get it. But
cases have talked about that. I don't know that any has done, because the question, again, is not what they can do, but what we cannot do. And the standard, this court has said, is abuse of discretion. And remember, Judge Herndon heard this twice. And at one point in December, he said, nope, this isn't enough. I'm not going to dismiss at this point. I need to go further. And we went on for another 3 months, another, I think, 17 briefs, another three arguments, until he
was focused on his epiphany about footnote 19 and the change in the language of the Ninth Circuit's opinion more than anything else, as if that was a sea change. And I agree with you, it's an abuse of discretion standard, but I'm concerned about the legal standard that we apply to analyzing this problem. And I'm not sure what legal standard he applied from what I've read.
I think he applied a question of whether it could be a fundamentally fair trial in light of all the disappearance of all this evidence and the length of time that had passed. And we suggested that states argued that this was pre-indictment delay. He's been in prison. He's been indicted for 34 years. It's not pre-indictment. He's not been put back in the position of somebody who's never been charged. He's been put back in the position of somebody who has been charged now for 34 years. So that analysis, I think, is there. And I think that under an abuse, it is a multifactorial question. But the reason the epiphany on the Ninth Circuit was so important was because Judge Herndon reached a very firm conclusion that Mr. Pike was wholesale ineffective. He said it himself several times, in addition to the Ninth Circuit saying it. And what I think the footnote clarified for him is that he was free to make that judgment, and that wasn't foreclosed by some kind of precedent.
May I ask one more question? Sure. So the Ninth Circuit expressly did not decide all those other issues.
Correct.
What do you say to... I guess your point is that Judge Herndon now has. Is that your argument, by excluding all the testimony and ruling as he did?
I think, yes. He has said he agrees with wholesale ineffectiveness. He says it's consistent with the standards and the findings, the written findings. It says it's consistent with the standards in the Clark County and in criminal defense and capital cases, which he's certainly in a position to judge. And if you look, and he goes down and he talks about it at length. Never asked Vanessa Wolf a single question about what happened that day. Never asked Randy Wolf. Never asked Ms. Elson. Thing after thing that Mr. Pike didn't do, that the circuit didn't reach because they didn't need to, because the other things were so egregious.
And I'm sorry. Do you read Judge Herndon as having independently made that evaluation of ineffectiveness, or was he of the understanding that the Ninth Circuit had made that finding and he was just following it?
He said, I agree with it. He said it's consistent with the standards. He said at one point, Randy Pike had no business trying this case. He said at another point, I don't believe anybody in this courtroom would believe that this was effective assistance. I think he was very clear about that, both in writing and orally. Thank you, Ron.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Giannacomo, we went over a little bit here, so we'll add leaving your time out of 5 minutes.
Thank you. Just on the legal standard, I am still confused how it is that a sitting district court judge can tell the Nevada Supreme Court you're wrong. Because the Ninth Circuit only finds those three things, all of which have now been cured. Judge Herndon took no additional evidence. All of these other issues where he's claiming Randy Pike was wholesale ineffective, and I don't know if he actually made that finding, because we didn't actually have any evidentiary hearing to establish that fact. We haven't had any analysis of what the prejudice was, what is out there that's not out there. All of that was done in 1999 by Judge Pawlikowski, and this court affirmed. The Ninth Circuit disagreed on three issues. But as to the rest of that, what All due respect, but what business is Judge Herndon saying the Nevada Supreme Court is wrong? And I've never really understood that argument. There are a few things that they brought up in their argument factually, and apparently they claim that I'm just wrong about the facts. But first of all, I want to discuss Marsha Gaylord. Marsha Gaylord, it has never been found that Randy Pike was ineffective for failing to acquire Marsha Gaylord. There was one 28-day continuance early on in this case in which Mr. Browning claims he lost the witness. She had sent him a letter in jail saying, I'm moving to Illinois and I'll let you know my new number. What was he supposed to do? Well, what did he do? He took it up to the Supreme Court. He took it to the federal district court, all of which rejected it, that it was a basis to dismiss the case. And Marsha Gaylord has been gone, as far as I know, ever since. Now, I don't know that she's dead. Maybe she's still alive. They can find her or they can't find her. But Marsha Gaylord has nothing to do with anything that's before this court right now. And it certainly isn't a basis for prejudice at all before in the arguments in front of Judge Herndon or with this court. As it relates to the knife, I can tell you that Mino Aoki never looked at the underside of that knife. Why? Because it's a brass knife with brass rivets, and the lab had to drill it out with their expert present. They had to drill the rivets off, flip the handle up, and that's where they found blood. Mino Aoki was not a DNA analyst. He looked at it and said there was no visible blood on the knife. The experts today will say, when that knife's together, there's no visible blood on that knife. They don't dispute each other one bit. They then took a drill, drilled it out, flipped it over, and found in, soaked in the wood some DNA. They did testing, and they say it's not conclusive. Well, it's one in 5.9 billion conclusive that it's Hugo Elson's blood. That seems pretty darn conclusive, considering the population of Las Vegas in 1986.
DNA show that Browning did it on the knife. I mean, even if it is his blood, how does it show that it's Browning versus the Wolves?
Because there's a witness who says, that knife I saw in Browning's possession a week before. And I would note during the PCR hearings, they spent a lot of time in 1999, you can look at the transcript, trying to argue that wasn't the murder weapon because it's not consistent with the wounds. That they were agreeing it was his knife, but now saying it's not the murder weapon. Well, we now know it's both. It's both his wife's knife and the murder weapon. As to the fingerprints, Stephen Scarborough is still around. They're free to call Stephen Scarborough and ask questions of Stephen Scarborough. And their expert talks about the fingerprint on top of the counter like this, but that could be consistent with someone leaning there. He has no explanation for how someone slid the door open, put their hand in, broke out the glass, and left their fingerprint on the inside of the glass. And one of the watches, the Bulova, this is now 2019. We now have certified latent print examiners instead of police officers who had been trained to do latent prints. We have a fingerprint on the Bulova watch that was clearly taken out of the crime scene and was found in the apartment with Mr. Browning. The last issue is sort of the Bert Lavos, Josie Elson issue. Josie Elson, as far as I can tell, has never said she saw the perpetrator leave the scene. Because as soon as she sees him stabbing her husband, she testifies, I ran out the back door to Deborah Coe. There's no statement of hers anywhere that I could find. What is in Burton Lavos' report is, as Burton Lavos is processing the scene, Miss Elson is taken out to a car, and she is interviewed. We don't know who the interviewer is, because Burton Lavos is processing the crime scene. And in there, he describes how she sees him do the perpetrator, and then he does write in the report, he ran out the front door. Now, could Judge Herndon allow that statement in some manner? Certainly he could, if Josie Elson even testifies. But if you exclude Josie Elson's testimony, well, why would you be cross-examining on her on anything? All of this is impeachment of Josie Elson. That's what the state has been precluded is, let me present my case, at least through the case in chief, maybe through verdict, maybe he gets not guilty. But let's not assess the prejudice before we know what the facts are.
Okay, thank you, Mr. DiGiacomo. Mr. Brown, thank you both for the excellent arguments and briefs in this case, and we will take this matter.